You get to San Diego.
Yep.
This is how many? This is the Buds. Like, for people that don't know what Buds is, can you describe that? This is process that people go through.
Yeah. So Buds is stands for Basic Underwater Demolition School. It's basically the selection process to become a Navy SEAL.
And people call it a course. Is it a course or is it like an actual selection process?
It depends on who you ask. So when I went, I don't know if it was called like a Navy course at that time. It was still like selection process or whatever. But then once the SEALs got their own rating, so I was a corpsman and that's how I went to Buds as a corpsman. But now kids are going already with the SO SEAL operator. It's an A school is what okay. they call it. So I went to core school as an A school. Buds was not considered an A school back then, but now it is. Now it's considered a course. Nothing's really changed about it, but just like some officer got promoted for changing the routine. But yeah.
What's that first part of this process to go through it?
So Buds is broken up into three phases, first, second, and third phase. And first phase is pretty much all that is a beat down.
When you say beat down,
it's a grind.
Nobody cares about whatever you did. Is it like, does that even factor in?
Heck
like
no.
You just went through all these schools. You just did all this training. You deployed. None of that matters.
None of that matters. I remember I had already had a combat action ribbon. So we had a dress blues inspection in Buds. And I was definitely singled out like, oh, look who this guy thinks he is, and beat me for that. I think there was a level of like respect at least, like, okay, this guy's done something, but it really doesn't factor into, if you're going to make it or not.
You don't want to stand out.
No, you want to try and be the gray man while you're in there. And I have my thoughts on that too.
What are these instructors? I imagine they're just trying to break everybody down mentally to try and make the people that shouldn't be there just leave.
Yeah, so that's all first phase. I mean, the whole entire Buds is like that. I mean, you're constantly being broken down and assessed. But the thing is they can't pull you out and be like, you're gone. You have to self-select. So that's why they have a bell, and you have to ring it three times and say, I quit.
What are you seeing that's breaking people the most around you?
Their own mindset. It's, I think anybody can go to Buds and survive a week of it. It's going to be hard, but it's knowing I have six more months of this, right? And I think people get in their heads like, I don't think I can do this for the next half a year getting treated like this and breaking my body down. So you'll see a lot of the quitters. It's either at 5 a.m. Right when we're about to go do the first evolution, the bell's just ringing because they wake up, they're beat down, they hurt.
And they just want to go. They just want to fucking rest.
Yeah, and then guess where you're going? In the cold water right off the bat. So that, I think people just mentally defeat. They get mentally defeated, and you can see it when guys. And I became a first phase instructor later on in my career, so I got a different look at it.
You got to see it both sides.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
So it's you can see these kids when they quit. It's like that split decision that they make, and then an hour later they're regretting it. It's like, bro, if you would have just showed up to the evolution and done it, like you don't.
These conversations are happening offline after they rung that bell.
Yeah, and I've had to talk to a couple of those kids as an instructor, and it's like, yeah, you let your mind defeat you. And your brain is always going to come up with as many excuses like, hey, let's not do this. It's going to.
And are some of these guys basically prepping themselves for this for months and yeah. if not years or their whole lives? Basically, yep. that's their shot.
Yeah. It's crazy to watch. I mean, I remember when we showed up to Buds the first day, we hadn't done anything and two quitters right off the bat because the instructors were like, we're going to go over to the pool and we're going to beat the shit out of you guys. So
in
just be prepared. The next 4 hours is going to be nothing but pain. And right off the bat, bing, 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 like without even doing anything. So that right there tells you, I mean, people get inside their own head.
And for people that might, you know, you were on both sides of that. And also later on, you took some of these people to war with you.
Yeah.
Why don't you want somebody like that with you in war?
Why don't I want somebody that's...
You're going to threaten, hey, we're going to go into the pool and I'm going to beat the shit out of you. And the guy says, I'm smart. I'm not going to go through that fucking shit. Let me ring this bell.
Yeah, well, I don't trust you. Like, I don't think you're willing. It's the willingness to give it all, right? It's like and that's the mindset I had in Buds. And I tell kids now that are going, you know, they always like, oh, what can I do to, you know, what's the secret to making it through? And I'm like, you die or you make it. Like, you accept the fact that if I die doing this, at least I die doing something that I'm trying to achieve. And the bottom line is you're not going to die, right?
There's people that might view that with a sense of superiority or saying, like, that's stupid. Allowing somebody, it's probably the same people that say, I wouldn't join the military because I would, you know, beat the instructor. The same, because I've met some people like that who are like, why would you allow yourself to go through that? Or why would you allow somebody to beat you in this way or abuse you? These words.
It's voluntary.
Exactly. How could you trust somebody with lives or to go somewhere where you need to take lives if they're that mentally weak and also independent?
Yeah.
Like, they don't think about anybody else. It's just like a narcissistic me thing. You can't have that.
So that's what Buds does, right? It weeds out the me, right? There's an expression, abandon self, embrace team. That's all Buds is. They are going to beat you down to your core, to your true self, and it will come out. Like, especially, I think the fourth week is called Hell Week. And so you only sleep for, I think, 3.5 hours that whole week.
What part does sleep deprivation have in this formation?
So that's where Hell Week comes in. So the rest of the weeks, you're getting, you know, 3-4 hours of sleep a night, which is fine.
Yeah.
You know, you can survive off that. And we have the weekends off.
Yeah.
So you have Saturday and Sunday to lick your wounds and get prepared for the upcoming week. But once Hell Week starts, that's like the big culmination of, you know, we'll see who's going to make it through this week. And usually the guys that make it through that week, that's your core.
How long do you go without sleep? Or like, what does that look like? It's sleep deprivation is basically, I think, 2 or 3 days in physical exertion, you're drunk.
Yep. Yeah. So this is the thing. Hell Week is like perfectly designed. So you have that 3.5 hours because that is the medically and scientifically, they're like, if you don't get that, you will die during this week. That's like, we're putting your body through so much that there is a possibility that your body will shut down. So we start off Sunday night. It starts around like 8 o'clock and then it ends Friday at noon. And so from Sunday to Friday, you are doing nothing but, I mean, running around with boats on your heads, log PTs, in and out of you're cold and wet entire week.
What happens if somebody goes unconscious or like nods off?
It happens. And you're just going to get beat down. But by that point, it's almost, you're selecting dudes out on their own, right? So it becomes so, like by Wednesday, if you have a guy under your boat that is not putting out like everybody else, it's like Lord of the Flies. It's like, kill him. Like, we don't want you with us. Like, you don't belong here. And that's just the nature of it.
It has to be, yeah.
Yeah. It forms that team, though. Like, these are the guys who are willing to give it all, and they are going to have your back. And it also teaches you that your pain is nothing.
Yeah.
Who cares about your pain? What about the guy next to you? That's why you're putting out. That's why you're putting that head under that boat when it hurts so much, is because you're trying to alleviate his pain, and hopefully he's doing the same for you. And that's where the teamwork aspect really comes into it.
You went through this multiple times on your end. What was that like? This going through buds. Like, did you go through it once?
Yeah, I went. I made it through. I got rolled second phase, diving phase of all things, because I grew up diving all the time. Yeah. But I got rolled for pool competency, and that's like
what happened.
Failure to follow instructions. So what they do during that is you are in the pool that week, and you're using these twin 80s, old school twin 80 tanks.
Yeah.
And you're crawling along the bottom, and the instructors come down and just beat the crap out of you, rip everything off, take your air off, and you have to go through these certain procedures, and everything has to be done to a T. And I think the reason I got rolled was because my pool tabs, when I was straightening it up, they have to be a thumb's length, and it was shorter. Was shorter than a thumb. And they were like, hey, that's a fail. And, you know, that happens. But I ended up classing up, you know, in second phase, the next class, and made it through the rest of the time, no problem. But, yeah, I mean, the amount of people that do get rolled during buds, there's a large percentage. Yeah. I mean, there's always something that's going to be a challenge. And that's a great thing about buds too, is
injury and death is,
but death will happen. Death they had happen one last has, year.
And this alarm that the public has when they see, like, hey, people are dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's part of the gig.
Dying is part of the nature and aspect of what you're doing there.
Yeah. And you know, and to be fair, like, they mitigate as much risk as possible, right? It's not like everything's willy-nilly and just, hey, we're going to go. Everything is, especially I found this out when I became an instructor. Everything is done intentionally, purposefully, to a T. And there's the risk mitigation is there. It's just, but you can't mitigate 100% risk.
Yeah, no, people might have pre-existing conditions, and anything that is there is going to express itself.
Yeah. But it should be like that. There should be that aspect of death. I think that makes it what it is, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I'm willing. You want the guys that are willing to give their lives for something, a bigger purpose, a higher purpose. And that's, you know, the higher purpose is becoming a SEAL and then going to war and being part of that community.
And this is, what year is this?
This is 04.
So this is before a lot of the books.
Yeah.
It's before a lot of the other aspects of it. You know, this is 04. I was starting on my own nonsense at that time. It's not that well known or talked about or seen. You know, it's still.
Yeah, I mean, there was a couple things that were coming out. That's when the Discovery Channel had done a whole thing on buds,
and it
was not as publicized and well known as it is now.
Yeah.
You know, this was pre Bin Laden.
You deploy again now, this time as a
SEAL.
As a SEAL.
Yeah. So I went to got my Trident, went to Special Operations Medical School in Fort Bragg, came back, checked into my team one, and then started work up, getting ready to deploy to Iraq.
Iraq.
Yeah.
What was that like? What's Iraq like at this point?
It was still hot and heavy. I mean, we were in HIT, which was, it's like an hour from Al Asad. And, we were just running DAs, sometimes, you know, nightly, two, three times a night. I'm just going to
direct action.
Yeah. Direct action.
Basically you were going out to start shit directly with people.
Oh yeah. I mean, so we went in, I had my chief at the time. He was super aggressive. We went into HIT, did a turnover. So there was a ODA, which is Green Berets. There was a unit there that we were turning over with. And they were like, hey, you know, giving us a lay of the land. And I'm like, we don't go into this area. This area is bad. And my chief's like, that's where we're going tonight. And we literally pulled into that area, sat there like, come fuck with us. Let's go. And, you know, being a new guy, I'm in the turret, like, okay, we're doing this. But yeah, that was the mindset. It was.
As you're going through your process of experience, doing these things, are you looking around some of the experienced guys? Is leadership something that attracts you?
Yeah, I mean,
because there's you know, it is one thing going through a process like that and becoming a part of something elite and, you know, great like this. It's another thing to go into leadership. That's like a different.
Yeah, leadership definitely wasn't on my to-do list at that time. Yeah. I was a new guy. I was like, dude, just don't fuck up. Don't die.
Don't get anybody else killed. Yeah. Figure this out.
Exactly. And just learn my job the best of my ability, which as a new guy, you really don't have a lot of responsibilities.
The people with you are all people probably of the same kind of generation as you. I mean, or is there any older guys there?
They were guys that had already done like one or two platoons. There was only a couple guys that had been to Iraq before. Most of them had not. So it was a lot of their first time as well.
So everybody was figuring shit out the fly.
Exactly. But there was like, we could pull from experiences though and learn what to do, what not to do before we got there. But it was also a lot of learning on the job.
Yeah.
Like you're like, all right, this didn't work. Let's try something else. And, you know, as far as like leadership at that time, I had some great E6s. They weren't in leadership roles, but they had already had some experience, and they really, I mean, they were all about the job. That was it. So I automatically like sort of went with those guys and learned from them as best I could.
What were you seeing in them that was... that you recognize as good leadership?
One is the dedication to the job and to going out every night and not taking any breaks. And the other is just like they were willing to teach you like, hey, man, this is like just little things at that point. As a new guy, it's like, why are you wearing your kit like that? Do this. Like, why do you have this? You know, this makes it just little things like that to
It's easy to call somebody stupid and just do that, but it's harder to be like, hey, correct.
Yeah, let me show you.
Correction and example. Way.
Yep.
Is,
and yeah, they were great mentors. You know, it wasn't, because there was other platoons that did not have that, right?
That we know everything guys, and you need to fucking catch up.
Figure it out, right? There's that mindset, which these guys were not of that. They were like, hey, let me show you what's, you know, how to do this correctly. And they also took the time to train us, on their off time.
And for people that, you know, don't know what this is like, this is basically, I mean, people think about the Olympics and people training their whole lives to be in the Olympics, right? And having that whole, that's all you did.
Yeah.
You were training up, this is the Olympics. This is people that don't understand the aspects of, say, fulfillment or satisfaction or even joy when it comes to war. This is something you've been preparing for.
It's funny, man. I've been trying to like for years now think of ways to like try to describe to people why we do these things and like why we wanted to go to war. And I'm like, it's our passion. Literally that was my passion. You know, people are passionate about different things. This is what I was passionate about. This is what my friends were passionate about. This is all we wanted to do.
This is something that I mean, you're not part of the norm, so that a lot of people can't understand that aspect of it. But the finding a purpose and then fulfilling that purpose in a place where, I mean, that's where the action was.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That aspect of it that people, I guess, that you say it's beautiful. For me, being somewhere where everything that I suffered through, that I learned on the hard way, that I can now put into action, and it matters.
Yeah,
there's a purpose to it. Purpose is the best drug on the planet. You know, if you find yourself in a place where you have purpose, and that's what you found there.
Oh yeah, yeah, like, for sure.
That's why all this shit was the way it was.
This is the culmination of everything that I've been through, and now I get to go play the game.
People now, you know, hindsight is 2020. It's another aspect that I think people don't realize. You're fighting a war, you know. I was prepared to do the job that I was, but I wasn't paying attention to politics.
No.
Or to reasons or are they good guys or are they bad guys? Are they freedom fighting? None of that.
Nope.
That's not on you.
No.
You're there doing
I'm doing. Yep, I'm doing whatever mission you're giving me. I'm going to go do it to the best of my ability.
So there's no sense of anything. Like, are we here for the right reasons? That aspect.
That came down later on in my career,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
But at that point, no. And, you know, and I'll say, like, back then, I think the country was on a different page. It was like everybody was sort of for what we were doing.
Yeah.
There
was a big general push.
Yeah.
To just sort this out.
Exactly.
And was the mindset that everybody had around that time that this is going to take, you know, a few years and then we're off?
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody had that worry, like, I'm going to miss it. I'm, you know, if I don't go on this deployment, then it's going to be over. So there was that aspect to it. But I don't think anybody really had a clue how long.
I remember having the experience of seeing people that weren't even born on 9/11 just figuring their way into. Yeah,
I was in charge of them. Yeah, like my last platoon.
This aspect of these kids.
Yep.
Basically joining up, and you're like, wait a minute.
And we can get into that, like the generational difference.
So the people that are with you are coming from this post 9/11 generation, and a lot of them are basically with you or figuring some of these things out. They're relearning how to become war fighters in a mm-hmm. lot of ways, because the military has a memory, and some of these parts of this memory just leave, you know, when there's a lull in conflict, although the U.S. is always into some shit somewhere.
Well,
which is,
you would think like we wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel each time, but we do.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, we're seeing it now too.
Your multiple deployments, I imagine, both in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
What aspects of the war are you seeing that you weren't, you know, like you weren't ready for this?
As far as like not being ready.
I mean, are you seeing, from afar, we start seeing IEDs being a thing.
Yeah.
And,
well, the enemy's always adapting. They're just as smart as we are, even though they work with, you know, little to nothing compared to what we have. They can adapt to everything that we're doing.
So you're always being watched, and they're taking notes.
Oh, yeah. You saw the, you know, the uptick in IEDs, and then just the different types of IEDs that they were being implored, you know, as the years went on.
So the freedom of movement at the start of the war versus later on, you started slowing down a little bit, I imagine.
Yeah, or having to adapt and come up with ways to mitigate getting hit by IEDs. I remember back then, we were in Humvees and you're in the turret, and we would have to, before we went under a bridge, you would switch over to one side and then switch over to the other each time, and because guys were trying to drop grenades on us, and they would also put wire out to decapitate the turret gunners. So that was, you know, little things like that were that kind of like went away later on in the war. But that back in 04, 05, 06, that was a main concern. Switching from Iraq to Afghanistan, you know, because that's what we would do. Those are two different environments.
Is the enemy, like, what I mean, I imagine the enemies are different.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, people from afar, they see, you know, two countries in the Middle East. And
yeah, they don't know the difference.
As an enemy, what are the Afghans like?
The Afghans, like, well, the Taliban, they were, to me, and, you know, people might have different opinions, they were better fighters. They knew their land, and they used it to their advantage. And it wasn't as urban as Iraq. It was a lot more open, so they knew how to use that terrain against us. And, you know, they were very good at getting the high ground. They were very good at ambushing, getting in L's. So we had to, you know, adjust to that as well. I liked fighting the Taliban more than I did the Al-Qaeda.
I mean, it's a home turf. They've been, you know, kicking out a few invaders for a few thousand years, probably.
Yeah. I mean, no one's conquered that place.
I don't remember who said that. You guys might have the watches, but we have the time aspect of it.
Yeah, I think I've heard that. Like, the problem with you guys is you wear watches. We don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have all the time in the world.
You, It was an interesting aspect. I mean, I've talked to people that were on both sides of that, and seeing their, you know, they're not sophisticated. They're not just this elite, but it's their place.
Yeah.
And they have a vested interest in defending this place that is, you know, probably generational, of course, with all these people. And they know all the trails.
Yep.
And they know all the hiding spots, and they know where to get food, and they know the land. That's a big advantage.
And like you said, they're constantly taking notes on what we're doing. And they also know what our rules of engagements are, so they know how to use that against us. I mean, they're not dumb,
yeah.
You know. But at the end of the day,
Afghanistan saw some of your community's greatest tragedies.
Yeah.
I can imagine. I can't imagine there like that. What that is like in that environment, far away. What was that feeling like, or the experience of like seeing some of these guys that were motivated, just specimens of humanity,
mm-hmm.
that all of a sudden just get blinked out of existence? They're gone.
I think for me, I think everybody has a different take on it. For me, and this is, I think, part of my issues that I deal with now getting out, I accepted the fact early on that I was going to die doing this job.
Death is
certain.
Certain.
It's coming at some point. And I lost. So when I left my Marine platoon and went to Buds, while I was in Buds, my Marine platoon deployed back to Fallujah, and I think like four of them got killed while I was in Buds. So I got that phone call, and then just I think that broke me.
When you say that broke you, like, again, I can imagine what that feeling is. A little bit of guilt, I guess, in the bottom of your stomach. This, I escaped that, and that somehow is bad on me.
Yeah.
And you weren't there.
Yeah, I had a real rough time. It was only lasted, I think, 2 or 3 days. I remember.
There's no time.
No, because I was focused on making it through. So I specifically remember I had a roommate. He's still one of my best friends. We, you know, had met in Bud, so we didn't know each other like that great. But I didn't tell anybody that I had lost four buddies. I was trying to, you know, keep it to myself. And then one night I broke, and I was like crying in front of him. And I, like, that was the first time I'd ever done anything like that. And he couldn't understand. He was like, "What's going on?" And I finally explained to him what had happened. And then I think something just snapped in me where after that, like, I completely went back to being hyper-focused. And yeah, then there's no time to feel anything anymore. I don't, like, I accept death. I accept that my friends are going to die. And so when guys started dying and I lost a lot more guys, you know, going through it, you know, I think the defense mechanism I had was just go back and get retribution, like,
yeah,
revenge.
The aspect of not having any time to mourn is, yeah, very much there, since it's a constant loss. Like, you have this one and it's like very close, and but you have to get ready for it because you're going to have to go do that other thing, yeah, now.
I can't let that get in my way of doing my job.
And for me at least, I lost a lot of people. But they were so quick and sometimes far that, mm-hmm, in my mind, I would always have to check myself to like, oh, let me call this guy. He's gone.
Yeah.
There's an aspect of it that you just don't have enough time to process.
Mm-hmm.
And
compartmentalize.
Yeah. So you just
put that away.
You have to. And the retribution aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
Of this. It's something that we're taught. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and I have a few scars on my hand from trying to write with my left hand from Catholic school. Nuns are great.
Oh, yeah.
And they put a few things in my head. Murder is a bad thing, you know? Thou shalt not kill. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're in this weird space where you're like, They did something and it took one of ours. So we are going to go and take
10 of theirs.
Yeah. This. Yeah. And having leadership, the leadership we had was all about that. But this strange drive that is black. There's a blackness to it, and people want to put light to it. And there is a need for it. It is an essential aspect of humanity, and it's always been with us.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a costly blackness that comes over us as far as like...
Yes, and you don't realize that until you're out of it, I think. I think while you're in it, everybody's on the same page. You know, you'll have your outliers, but everybody's in that momentum, you know, and you're not the only one. Everybody else can't process anything either. And so it's like, just, we're going to keep going back and trying to get the job done and try and take as many of them out as possible.
And it's a drive. It's almost like a deep breath before a plunge. It's like, oh, these motherfuckers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. It's like a second breath in a lot of ways. And it's in us. It's not something artificial or... Like, people want to talk about the military programming you, or like people being trained and having this put in them. That shit is with us. It's prime. Primal thing.
Yeah.
And you have to shut everything off around it. This mourning, the mourning aspect of it, just being able to bury somebody and being there and comforting family or friends around there's just no time.
No, even when you go to the funerals, it's like, got it, he's gone, let's go.
Yeah,
like it's, you know, and you do have, I mean, and that's the things I've had to process since I've been out, just even mourning all my friends that have, like, finally mourning all my friends that I've lost. I mean, I would try to when I was in, you know, I knew enough to like, dude, I should feel sad, or I should feel something. And the only way I could get any type of emotion out, and I had just told my wife this the other day, is, you know, I would literally punish myself. I'd go on like a 20-mile run, and I would go so hard and so fast it would drive tears out.
Mix with the sweat.
Yeah, and that's when I would be like running a 5:30 pace, hauling ass, and crying. Because that's the only way I could get any type of emotion out of me.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how blocked off I was.
Yeah.
And, you know, still a little bit to this day, I have that. But
alcohol, is any of that there around?
Yeah. Alcohol, definitely. I mean, that's part of the community. It's
For us, it was like, hey, you know, you get a day off and you get the bottle.
Yeah.
Figure that out.
I mean, yeah, alcohol is always... That's always present. You know, I try to, you know, my early on, I didn't go towards it as much. But then the more and more I kept deploying, and just the more and more I would start drinking. And
for people that don't know what we're looking for, what were you looking for in the effects of alcohol?
Numbness,
a pause button.
Yeah.
I haven't had a drink in 3 years. I think at Christmas I got 3 years sober.
Nice. Congrats.
Thank you. I miss the dead, dreamless sleep.
Yeah.
Of it.
Yeah.
That amazing pause button that it would give me, so I can just shut that shit off, so I can wake up the next day hungover and in pain. But I deserve that, and let me fucking keep pushing forward.
And then I'll go punish myself for being hungover, and I'll get rid of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the cycle for sure. It's
a Catholic fucking whip that somehow we got inherited. Yes.
the crushing guilt.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and plus I had, you know, my wife and I had 3 kids. So that was a whole nother aspect of
what your wife. Talk to me about her. Where did you meet her?
So me and her were best friends in high school. She went to a different high school than I did, but we had linked up and just went out partying all the time together. Just we were never like a thing. We just be liked being around each other. And then she ended up moving to Florida when I went to go join the Navy. We sort of lost contact. She got pregnant by some other dude there and ended up getting married. And then I ended up running into her right before I checked into SEAL Team 1, my first platoon. I went home to just see my parents and ran. Like, we ended up hooking up.
Weird.
Yeah.
What's meant for you is what you're looking for is looking for you is something I heard once. So she appeared.
Yes. It's all divine intervention, yeah, and God. Like, we were supposed to be together, and when I ran into her, it was like time had never passed. She had recently been divorced, and we kept that relationship, like, long distance relationship for a year, and we were like, let's just call this what it is. Let's get married. So we ended up getting married before my first deployment.
She's with you from the start of that.
Yes, through everything. We're both green, you know, going into it. She always tells me, she tells everybody, like, she had no idea what she was getting into. I didn't, you know, he didn't tell me what I was in for. But at the same time, I tell her, I was like, I didn't know what I was in for. Like, yeah, it's, we went into it together. And she learned real quick.
What's the difference in your life before and after her? Like when you're going through this process of, you're focused.
Yeah.
I mean, you're figuring out some, this is the closest thing to superhumanity. You know, some of the aspects of what you're going through as far as training, what you're training up to do in the groups that you're in. And somehow this figure of this woman is there.
Mm-hmm.
What changes for you with her?
Everything. I mean, she had two kids, but they were, you know, Trevin and Ava. Trevin was 5, Ava was, I think, 2, or he might have been 6, and she was 2. So I went from single, focused, hyper-driven to, I came back from that deployment, and I was married with 2 kids.
What did you have to change?
I had to change a lot. I'm a stubborn individual. I think we both had to adapt to each other. But it wasn't hard. The fact that we were so close, and I mean, I knew she was the one I wanted her, you know, I wanted to be with her. I knew she was the one for me. So I did my best. And, you know, I can honestly say I did my best to try and be the best husband and father while doing that job. And I failed miserably at it multiple times. But
she stayed.
Yeah, she stayed. She's a fighter. She's the definition of Spartan wife.
When you say she's a fighter, did she fight you, basically?
Hell yeah.
To stay? Did you try and push her away in the ways that we as men do? We don't even know that we're doing it.
For years. Yeah. Especially like when the drinking and all that. I mean, I would come home. Eventually it was like I'd come home, you know, go grill out, drink 6 beers, and be completely numb.
And you were not present. And no, that's what she fought you
She
over.
Fought. Yeah.
Come back.
Yeah, nonstop.
I mean, it's not just coming back from where you're coming back, but like, come back. Like, yeah, you're here now.
Be here with us.
Be present, which is
at that time, easy. It almost seemed like an impossible task. Because even when you're present, you're not. I'm thinking about the job, or I'm thinking about what I got to do next. And plus, you're in that bubble of just being in the community. So everything that we do revolves around the community. The community, it owns you in a way.
Is she meeting some of the guys that you're working with?
Oh, yeah. When I had her, before we got married, I had her come down, and I was actually living with 2 of my best friends who are both dead now, Brad Kavner and Aaron Vaughn. And she came down and stayed, and I think it was probably one of the most meaningful conversations that we were at Danny's, and I actually wasn't there. She was there with Brad, and Brad pulled her aside, and I think this is where she got it. He looked at her, and he's like, I just want you to know, like, he's going to come home, you know, after this deployment. We will die for him. like dead serious, looked at her in the eyes, and she still brings up that conversation, and she's like, that was when she realized, like, this is the life, you know.
I get it. Yeah.
And she took that on.
You know, women that stay, because I've gotten to meet women like that are, you know, blessed and cursed, I guess, to be attached to people yeah. like you and me and some of the ones that stay adapt, but they also find their own purpose.
They have to be independent.
Yeah.
Yes.
They find their own purpose. But they also become amazing readers of people. And sometimes we're drunk and stupid in our bubble that we are inhabiting. And they see some of the people that we work with. And they see through shit. This yeah. is far as some of the people that are around us. And I don't know, for me, for a long period, I had somebody that would, you know, tell me, warn me about things. And what would you know?
Prophetic. Yeah.
Prophetic.
Yes.
Because women
She is, for sure.
Yeah. Women not have, you can call them prophets, you know, or superhuman pattern recognition. That is very much ingrained into their evolution.
Especially when they're, Andrea's always been a woman of faith. That was like a deal breaker when we got married. Like, she's like, if you do not follow Christ, like, this is the way I...
Christian.
Yes. And I was Catholic.
Which means...
Yeah, so I'm like, oh, yeah. Like,
weekend. I get it. I'm Christian. I'm Catholic, too, and I, you know, I'm still figuring my thing, my spirituality out. But I get it, you know, when I meet somebody who's like a Christian, who is like, this is the specific structure.
Yes, these are our values. I mean, even to the point where we didn't have sex until we were married. That was also, you know, and she, I mean, it was a struggle for both of us, believe me. But it, to me, I'm like, that paid off dividends. And I think that's just like one aspect why our marriage was so strong. But it was following those values that she laid out. And I mean, I was a willing participant. I was like, yes, I'll whatever you want, you know, but not really understanding the fullness of
what, why.
Yes. She, you talked about the prophetic nature, she would always be able to tell me, like, you shouldn't do that. If you go do that, something's going to happen.
So this is a weird aspect. Like, do you share? I mean, a woman, I don't know, this, I have a strange relationship with women, I guess. I just haven't found the right one. You either share too much or you share too little. And you don't want to worry them, you know, with like, hey, we're going to go after these people that are on the news that are, you know, hanging people from bridges. You don't want to share that with them. But on the other hand, you come back with this worry, pain, anger or whatever, and it's unnamed. And some women will take it as, it's me that is the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you find that? How did you guys find the balance of...
We went to counseling multiple times. That's the one thing I will say is we were both always doing work to make it work.
So it wasn't like, hey, you have to go to counseling.
There was definitely, there's definitely finger pointing because it was the unknown for both of us. I mean, coming back from certain deployments, I had issues. Yeah. And I think we both learned real quick. When I come back from deployment, it's going to be about 2 or 3 months for me to like come back to any type of normalcy or, you know, what we thought was normalcy back then. But that was a process. I mean, it was after multiple deployments when we finally got our groove, but we went
both
through
of you working in.
Yeah. We both went to counseling a couple times, you know, and not, you know, I think the counseling did some good, but at the end of the day, it was on us to make it work.
Midnight conversations at the soul with your wife in the middle of a dark room, fucking truth being cast out.
Yeah. And that's the thing is she knew, Because I'm not a very big communicator. And that's the way my family, I was raised. Like, no one talks about their emotions. No one.
Suck it up.
Yeah, you suck it up and move on. Where she was more like, you need to express yourself. And she's a very expressive person. She'll let you know exactly what she's thinking and feeling. And I'm the complete opposite. Even though she's like, it's written all over your face. So I had to learn to be more communicative, but I failed at it multiple times. We'd have certain moments where I'd come back from deployments and I'd be drinking and I'd break down and I'd tell her about something that happened. And I wouldn't remember telling her. And she'd be like, you told me about that. And I'm like, oh shit. But that was my way of like getting it out.
Yeah. Some people don't understand that aspect of femininity or a woman. You're allowed, I think, on my end, when I've never found on my end, I was never allowed to be weak or break like that with a woman.
No.
Because, like, I imagine that we probably have a similar parenting backgrounds, and that wasn't allowed, or you didn't see your dad do that.
No.
And
there's no crying.
There's no, and also you're the man, so you should, you know, drink it off and don't bring that shit home.
Yeah.
Aspect of it.
Yeah, that's the, you know, the old school, like, you know, the men go to the bar, have some drinks, you know, bitch about their day, or like, that's how they decompress before they go home. You know, that's how my, you know, like, that's how I was brought up, or like, thought that's what men do, you know, and they don't show any emotion. They don't show any feeling. They're the strong, stoic, and you should always have the answer to what's going on. That's a lot harder it's a lot harder to do once you're in that position, I guess. And
you found her.
Oh, dude.
Or she found you.
The biggest blessing.
But you both found each other, I guess.
Yeah.